Off the Ball.
Find us on Twitter at Off the Ball.
News Talk 106 to 108.
Good afternoon, and you're very welcome along to the Champions Lounge here at the Crucible Theatre in Sheffield. It's not often you get a Monaghan and Tyrone man sitting beside each other not talking about GAA, but we're going to talk about snooker. Dennis Taylor, the 1985 World Snooker Champion, is beside me. Dennis, how are you?
I'm absolutely brilliant, Shane. Might get a bit of noise from these former world champions. You know, they are noisy. The darling of Dublin, Ken Doherty. I can hear him in the background. Sean Murphy, another world champion. And, of course, the king of the Crucible, Stephen Hendry, he's there as well. So all getting ready to go and do our commentary.
Absolutely. Dennis, from reading up, I know a lot of, I guess, playing snooker in the 70s and 80s, you would have had to move across to the UK. I know Ken is one person who did that. He moved over to Ilford. Yourself, you moved over to Blackburn at quite a young age to stay with your aunt. How are those early days? I know you worked in a paper mill, so you're quite a hard worker, it sounds like.
I had to. I came over just to work, not to play snooker. I didn't realise how good it was until I arrived in Blackburn and got into the local snooker club and found I was as good as the local players. Because I'd only played around Coal Island and within a 12-mile radius, roughly. But I found I wasn't bad, and I started to play a lot more, but did all sorts of jobs, as you mentioned there, Shane. Worked 12-hour shifts in a paper mill to earn a few quid, and worked in a shop, and then managed a snooker club. So did a variety of things before eventually turning professional with the help of the great John Spencer, who was three times world champion.
A lot of people talk about 1980s snooker and that being, the peak of the game for some up to this point. But 1970 snooker was quite an interesting time. I mean, emergency generators, power in the rooms, people sitting on beer crates, dodgy characters sitting left, right and centre as well. So what was life like? You mentioned Spencer and Reardon, and you had guys like Eddie Charlton as well. But what was it like playing snooker in the 1970s?
Well, some of the clubs that were around, I mean, where I used to practice with Alex Higgins, because he moved over to Blackburn. We met up in Coal Island when we had a show to do after he'd won the All-Ireland snooker, and I'd won the British billiards, junior billiards. And then he moved to Blackburn, and the club, you know, they weren't the nicest venues in the world, but Lancashire was always a hotbed of snooker, and I played so many. I played hundreds upon hundreds of frames with Alex and Jim Meadowcroft. You know, we had a couple of snooker clubs that we used to go in. We knew the owners, and that was how we used to play and learned a lot from each other, you know. So the 70s, when Alex first won his world title, that was at it was a working men's club with tiered seating, and there was pint glasses falling off the tiered seating and smashing all around the place. And of course, the game really took off when they moved it to the Crucible Theatre in 1977. That was when the game really started to take off.
A lot of people know, obviously, about your Crucible success and your Master success in 87 as well. But from reading up, there was one particular, it was the 1974 Canadian Open. Maybe I know you're over with Cliff Thorburn, but there was quite an extraordinary record you set over in Canada that year.
Yeah, people tend to forget about that. I did get to the final that year and I beat Alex Higgins in the semi-final, you know, which he was probably the top player in the game then. But in an exhibition against the Montreal champion, Atomic Eddie Agger, he was called, little French-Canadian, great character. And in the exhibition we were playing, I finished the frame with a century break. And then it was my turn to break off, and I fluked a red and cleared the table with 134. And then he broke off, and I made another century. So it was 349 without missing a shot. And through that, and getting to the final, I got an invite into Pot Black. And then that was the start of it. It then took me 13 years to build my way up to the top.
Before I get to that route to the top, the glasses. I have to talk about the glasses. I mean, Jack Carnham, I think, the BBC, was he a producer with the BBC back in those days? But he was quite influential in, I guess, getting the glasses on your face in the first place.
Well, Jack Carnham was the commentator for the BBC, but he also was a professional player at both billiards and snooker, probably more renowned for being a billiards player. But he used to make spectacle frames. That was their family business. And I'd seen the pair that he used to use, but he never appeared on television with them. So I went and stayed with him for 2 days, and he made the pair that I won the world championship with by hand. So without Jack Carnham making those upside-down glasses, which they looked like they were just turned upside down, a lot of hard work went into designing them and getting the optical centre where it should be. But good old Jack, God rest his soul, helped me to lift that world title eventually.
Yeah, because I saw you, I think it was in Johannesburg in 84 maybe, where you were maybe gave the glasses a debut or an early run out anyway. And you kind of said yourself, they became a great gimmick, but without them you might not have won the world championships. Is that fair?
Yeah, they weren't intended to be a gimmick, but everybody said, you know, the fellow, they all... And at that time, ladies' spectacles frames were... I remember Deirdre out of Coronation Street wearing the big glasses with the sides down the bottom. So they were designed just around the time when I was wearing mine. So it did create quite a bit of interest, the old upside-down glasses. And a lot of people thought they were a gimmick, but they were purely to help me to see what I was doing out there. And it did make a vast difference.
What some people might not realise is that in the build-up to the World Championships, you had quite a life-changing moment yourself personally. I think it was maybe the Jemison tournament in Newcastle when your mum, Annie, passed away quite suddenly. I mean, I know from reading up she was only 62, slim woman, good health. That must have been quite a life-turning moment for you as well, personally.
Yeah, well, I didn't really want anything to do with snooker after that. I was playing the best snooker in my career in the Jemison tournament. I think I'd got to the quarter-final stage and was really looking forward to it. And then you get the devastating news, and I'll never forget the drive. Well, I can't remember much about the drive back from Newcastle to Blackburn and then going home. But my family, and they all persuaded me to go and play in the Rothmans Grand Prix. And they said, go and play for your mum. And I did. And I just never looked like... I won the semi-final. I think it was 9-2 against Neil Foles, and then won the final against my good buddy Cliff Thorburn. 10-2. Played some unbelievable snooker. So it was down to my dear old mum. And she helped me when I was in the Crucible, because while Steve was kept clearing up frame after frame, I was having a little chat to my mum. And I think she helped me as much as anybody else to make that comeback against Steve, yeah.
I've been reading, obviously, I'm sure you're never asked about the 1985 World Final, but it's a moment that a lot of people, I guess, remember where they were watching it. My own dad was the only Garda on duty in Emmyvale Garda Station along the Monaghan-Tyrone border, while a Tyrone man was obviously walking around the table putting that black. Barry McGuigan, I think he was in training for his fight against Pedroza, the world featherweight bout, and he says he remembers watching that and looking at you sitting in your seat thinking, I wonder what he's thinking about right now. But I know your mother was probably in your thoughts as well, but the psychology of sitting there, I guess, and people wondering what you're thinking, it's quite a notable thing, and it's one of those moments that everyone remembers where they were.
Yeah, I used to pretend to watch Steve playing, but I was looking underneath the table because he used to dominate the place, so I didn't want to sit there just watching him clear up after frame after frame after frame. But I knew I'd played well throughout. I'd got to the final with a session to spare in the semi-final, session to spare in the quarter-final. I knew I was playing great snooker, but I wasn't getting any chances. And in the evening session of the first day, I did get the chances, and I won 6 frames in a row, most of the frames won with one visit. So even though I was 2 behind at 9-7, I felt like I'd won the session. So I just hung in there and stuck with him. And never in my wildest dreams did I believe it was going to go down to the very last black. And people to this day still talk about it. And it was just great to have been involved in a bit of snooker history then.
It was. I watched it back the other night, the last frame with my brother, and interestingly, my brother hadn't realised, he wasn't aware of who was going to come out on the winning side. So it was fascinating to watch it with someone who was watching it live, as it were, in their own minds. But even the way you kind of carried yourself, you went over and kissed the trophy at one point, I think, and you're kind of joking and smiling, the two of you, really. And it shows a lot about your mental strength, both yourself and Steve Davis, that you were able to actually have a joke when this was clearly the biggest moment of your career.
Yeah, well, I mean, we were both in bits in that last frame. That's why it lasted nearly 68 minutes. We were playing good safety play, but we were missing chances simply because of the pressure of it going down to the very last frame, and then to go down to the colours, and then to go down to the very last black. I mean, I've said it so many times, with each shot in that last frame, Steve was getting whiter by the shot, and I was getting redder by the shot, as I used to do under pressure. So, yeah, we had no idea it was going to go to the final black. And I happened to be the lucky wee fella from County Tyrone that managed to knock that final black in. And as I say, even to this day, people will come up and chat about it. I never get fed up with people wanting to talk about that. It was great, as I said, to have been involved in such a final.
A massive moment in your career followed 2 years later when you won the Masters. I guess the man you were playing there was Alex Higgins, and he's a man who, well, you had different incidents with over the years. He was quite a character in the game. But that was a final where you were down and out, and there was an incident, I think, with a couple of bottles of champagne maybe that inspired you to victory that day.
It was. Trevor East was with me, who was with me throughout the World Championship. And he said to me, I was 8-5 down and we went out, and he said, Alex's manager, I think it was Howard Kruger, has just ordered a dose of champagne to celebrate Alex winning his first tournament for 2 years. And that was all I needed. That was the inspiration. And I went out and won the last four frames to knock Alex out.
Dennis, it's been a pleasure. Thanks, as always.
All the best, Shane.
Off the ball.
Find us on Twitter at Off the Ball.
News Talk 106 to 108.